Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Hinwood, the usual two guests today. First, Sharon Higgins will tell us about the Turkish Islamist cleric Fethullah Gulen and his network of charter schools across the U.S. and his web of intrigue around the globe. And at the bottom of the hour, the economist Robert Polin will take apart Donald Trump's so-called economic plan. First, Sharon Higgins. She is an Oakland-based education activist who runs a very useful website called Charter School Scandals. There's plenty of material there. Higgins has been following the activities of a Turkish imam named Fethullah Gulen, who's deeply involved in Turkish politics, may well have CIA ties, and is accused by the increasingly dictatorial Erdogan regime of having plotted the recent coup against him. It's all very murky. Here's Sharon Higgins to demurkify. Welcome, Sharon. First, who is this Gulen fellow?
Gulen is an imam who lives in Pennsylvania right now. He's been living in the United States since 1999. When he fled Turkey because he was about to be arrested. He has a group of followers, and they're known as the Gulen Movement by people who are not part of the organization. The organization itself prefers to be called Hizmet, which means service.
And what does he and it stand for?
He's an Islamist. As things are evolving now, we're learning more and more and more about the nature of the Gulen movement ever since the coup in Turkey and different articles that have come out. What he believes and what they profess is different, I believe, than what their actions are. They profess interfaith dialogue and importance of education. Those are probably the two main things that they boast about. But really, quite a lot of it is this secret brotherhood that has ulterior motives. For example, they run a huge charter school network in the United States. It's believed, you know, that they've tapped into this corporate-style, market-based education reform movement, and that they're getting millions and millions of dollars every year. It's estimated they're getting now about $500 million per year for their charter schools. It's perpetual funding as long as they can boast the high enough test scores. And so there's an incentive there to rig test scores, I believe. All these things need to be investigated.
There are all kinds of rumors that swirl about Gulen, including that he's got something to do with the CIA. A prominent former CIA agent, Graham Fuller, has refuted those claims, which, you know, he's perhaps not the most credible source one can mobilize for this. What about that? What do we know about his political affiliations, if at all?
What I've read in terms of his CIA connections, you know, of course the CIA is not going to let us know any of this. He was born in 1939, and by the time in the 1960s, 1970s, he had become an imam, and he was going around different towns in Turkey and preaching, and he started to collect this group of followers. He was, you know, staunchly anti-communist and, you know, very religious. Eventually, they opened summer camps for the followers to come and get some training with, you know, tutoring and religious education, and those evolved into schools in Turkey. Now, once the Soviet Union dissolved around 1992, then Gulen's followers went out beyond Turkey's borders, and they've just been expanding globally around the world. It's thought that CIA members were embedded with his schools as they first went beyond Turkey's borders into the Central Asian Republic areas to establish schools. Two CIA, former CIA members were involved with writing letters on behalf of Gulen for his green card. You know, he came here, he had his visa, and then he applied for a green card a few years later, and that was declined, but his lawyers appealed, and then these letters, a host of letters was submitted. And we might want to ask, you know, what was the connection between those two CIA, former CIA members, and why are they writing letters on Gulen's behalf? So there are connections there that need to be investigated.
And he got his green card, so I guess it worked.
Yeah, he did. He got, I think, in like 2007, 2008.
And he lives in rural Pennsylvania, and the Turkish government wants him in Turkey, right?
Exactly. He and the President Erdogan had a very close alliance from, you know, say the early 2000s on. Gulen's followers were educated. In fact, many of them are in the United States, and these are the ones that are opening the charter schools. A lot of students and followers of his would get their bachelor's degrees in Turkey and then would get accepted into graduate school in the United States. So, and many of the individuals who started the charter schools, the founding members, were either graduate students or just out of their postdoc, very quite young Turkish men, highly, highly educated. With the schools that he operated and then moving his educated followers into positions in the Turkish government, in the judiciary, in the police force, they started the largest newspaper in Turkey, Zaman, which has now been taken down, and it had an English component, Today Zaman. There were only two English-language Turkish newspapers available. All of Gulen's followers and his media propelled Erdogan into power. And this went along for quite a while until about 2012 when there was a conflict involving someone who was very close to Erdogan, a government official. But the Gulenists went after him. After that, there just started to be this dispute. Now, one of the things that they did together, the AKP, which is the ruling party in Turkey, and the Gulen movement, like I said, they were allies. And, they're both Islamists. They're both very business-oriented. So one of the things that they accomplished was to kind of root out the power of the secularists. And that was accomplished with a series of show trials, and locking up generals and locking up journalists who were critical of the Gulen movement. There's a famous arrest incident that happened with a well-known journalist who wrote a book called The Imam's Army. It had not been published yet, but as they're arresting him and putting him to the car, he yells out, "Anyone who touches them gets burned," and this means the Gulen movement, because he was exposing the Gulenist presence in the police force. The secularist power was diminished by removing these officers, secularist officers under this phony trial. And then the Gulen movement moved its military members into those positions. And it's felt, at least by some at this point, that that's who led the coup, was the newer officers who had been placed into their positions since the trials of the, it was called Ergenekon and Sledgehammer. There were a couple of different names to them. In the 2007, 2008, 2009. That's where we are today, is that this portion of Gulen's followers appear to have attempted this coup. Before that, the tension between Gulen and Erdogan has been going on. They ruptured completely in December 2013, and it's been very testy ever since. Erdogan's done these mass sweeps and arrests of academics and people in the media, and it's said that he was about to go in and yank out all the Gulen movement associated members of the military, and they got wind of that, and that's why they made this move in July, mid-July, with the coup, attempted coup.
To turn to the charter school network here in the U.S., just to put that into context, the Gulen movement has a network of schools around many parts of the world, right? The United States is just one part of a larger picture.
Yeah, they operate schools on every continent. However, from my understanding, the United States is where they have most of their schools next to Turkey itself. And, of course, their schools in Turkey have now been closed by the government. But they have schools all through Central Asia, they have schools in Australia, Europe, many countries in Europe, Canada, Mexico, few in South America, a lot in Africa, very heavy movement in Africa, some in India. So it's interesting with the timing. I've always thought this, it was just a matter of luck for the Gulen movement that they, around the same time that they were able to extend their school, global school expansion project beyond Turkey's borders after the fall of the Soviet Union, was around the same time that the United States passed its first charter school law. So this is, first charter school law was passed in 1991 in Minnesota. And charter school laws are state-by-state effort. So there are only, I think, 5 states left right now that don't have charter school laws. By 1997, the Gulenists were starting nonprofits, which would then go on be the organizations that would apply for a charter school. So, for instance, in California, they started a nonprofit in 1997 and took a couple of years to get their application together and then applied for their first charter school in California. It was approved by the LA Unified in 2000 and was opened shortly after. I think 2001 was opened shortly after. There's a whole collection of these charter schools being started by Turkish men fitting the same profile in Georgia, in Ohio, in Texas, in California, just in many states. And then they just have accumulated their charter schools ever since. So, well, for the last school year, they operated 155 charter schools in the country. It's the second largest. At one point, a couple of years ago, it was the largest network, even though it doesn't display itself as a singular network. It is. It was larger than KIPP. Right now, KIPP has surpassed the Gulen charter schools in number, but my sense from just looking at some of the enrollment figures provided by state agencies and having tracked them for a couple of years is that the enrollment is equal. It's around 70,000 students are enrolled in this network of schools.
Let's speak with the education activist Sharon Higgins.
You said earlier that they're getting hundreds of millions of dollars of public money for these charter schools. It is a religious organization. I'm sure there are many scandals here, but that's one that really leaps out. Is this a violation of our normal rules of separation of church and state?
Well, the Gulen movement is very careful about not teaching religion explicitly at its schools. One of Gulen's teachings is for his followers to not try to... the word I'm trying to think of, another word.
Proselytize.
Proselytize, yeah. They're taught to not proselytize overtly, okay? Their model, supposedly, is to just be this example of good Muslims, of pious Muslims, and exemplify this lifestyle. You really can't say that there's teaching of religion going on at the school. For me, the best way to look at this group is that it's a cult, and it's a closed group. It's a collective. They've got their allegiance to someone else, to their cult leader, and it's not illegal for a foreign cult to operate charter schools in this country, especially because they are constantly, repeatedly deny the connection, even though there's just a mountain of linkages that indicate that these schools are connected to Gulen, including in having children learn songs with lyrics that are from based on Gulen's poetry, you know, and then they perform these songs or recite the poetry at Turkish language competitions. I mean, but that's just one of many, many, many connections between the Gulen movement and the schools.
What do you think they're trying to do with these schools?
Well, I think one thing is that they're tapped into this business model, and they're getting a lot of money. Now, the Gulenists, these schools hire American teachers, and in some schools there are a lot of American teachers, but they always have Turkish teachers. The top administration is Turkish men, pretty much. Sometimes you'll see their wives there Sometimes they have American wives, and the American wives will be sitting on the boards. But the control of the curriculum, and especially the control of the money and how that's directed, is always in the hands of the Gulenists. So we don't know what money is being skimmed off to go to wherever they want it to go. Right now I'll mention this new film called Killing Ed. It was released in March. It's kind of making its rounds around the country. It doesn't have a distributor right now, but I'm interviewed in it. But the filmmaker also interviewed former teacher of one of these schools in Ohio who was brought over, and he had to give 40% of his income back to the movement in cash. This has been reported by other teachers, you know, where they bring these Turkish or Turkic. They're almost always Turkish, but sometimes they're Turkic, meaning they are the graduates of Gulen schools in Azerbaijan or, you know, Tajikistan, someplace like that. Okay, so they're these teachers that come over on visas. They get considerably larger salaries than the American teachers, but then it's believed, and then was also confirmed by this one teacher, that a portion of their salary is then going back in cash to the Gulen movement money collector, who covers a region, you know, part of the brotherhood.
Now, you run a website called Charter School Scandals, so you're very familiar with this field. I mean, how do they fit into this smelly universe?
Well, they're taking advantage of every loophole and lack of oversight factor that is part of the charter school industry landscape. They do things like set up, there was a big New York Times article in 2011 about how they have set up these construction companies, and then the Harmony Public Schools will have these related party construction companies build the schools, you know, without any competitive bidding process. You know, they also have used their own catering companies. They'll have their friends start catering companies, and then those catering companies supply food to the schools. And it doesn't happen in every state. It depends on how developed this is. Texas is particularly developed, and Texas has the largest number of their charter schools. And this group has been extremely influential in Texas. Now, and another thing, you know, in addition to the charter schools, you know, we have to realize that the Gulen movement is extremely active in this country and has been for, you know, decades. You know, making office visits to politicians, massive campaign contributions, big ones to Hillary Clinton. The Clintons have long ties with people in the Gulen movement and the Clinton Foundation. You know, but that's just one of many, many politicians that have been pursued by the Gulen movement. And they don't care if they're Democratic or Republican. You know, I found a guy, I was looking around on yesterday on doing some research, and there's a guy who gave a huge contribution to the GOP in Louisiana. He's a Texas Gulenist who doesn't run charter schools, but he runs one of their other organizations there. They have these interfaith dialogue organizations and Turkish cultural organizations, hundreds of them across the country. So he's also given really major contributions to Democrats. So it's not by party. They're interested in getting close to anyone that's in a position of power and kind of glom onto them and to influence them in any way. And we're seeing that influence now in the response that people are having to this attempted coup. Now, Turkey is a NATO ally. We've got an air base there. It seems that, you know, even though, you know, I mean, Erdogan is definitely authoritarian, but the United States has not been forthcoming about its relationship with Gulen. I can't think of any, maybe a couple politicians over the years or public officials who have even mentioned the word Gulen and has gone into the fact that they run this chain of charter schools. Newspapers will write op-eds siding with the Gulenists. And then, you know, you find out that maybe, oh, you know, that they have taken a trip to Turkey from the Gulenists years ago. I mean, their impact here and influence here is huge, and it just has yet to be uncovered.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot going on here, but we really can't tell for sure, and it needs some serious scrutiny.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one good thing now about the coup, from my point of view, and I don't think very much is going to be good about it because of the tension, you know, there's like really increasing anti-American sentiment rapidly, you know, going up in Turkey over Gulen and the fact that he's still here. I mean, Erdogan, of course, called for his extradition. They're working on that right now, whether that'll happen or not. But from my perspective, one thing that's good about this whole situation right now is that more and more people are learning about the existence of this group, its presence in the United States, and are starting to understand the nature. You know, you really need to understand its MO, because it has a certain way that it has been operating here. People don't realize that those nice Turkish men who are knocking on their office doors, you know, this the congressman, you know, this nice Turkish men coming to visit them, they're not telling them, the Americans, they haven't been telling the Americans that they're part of this political, religious, secretive, controversial religious group. And that's been going on for years. So, yeah, the Gulen movement has been everywhere here. When you start looking into it, they've been to many, many, many local, state, federal officials. They've hosted state house events. They call them cultural events. They've given many, many, many trips to Turkey, these guided trips to Turkey. Those have stopped now, of course, but, you know, in the old days, they would get a batch of people together and take them there, and it's just this immersion for 10 days. And, you know, they'll visit cultural sites or, you know, sightseeing sites, but then they'll also take them to visit, you know, all these Gulenist sites. They'll take them to Gulen schools, the Gulen media. So it's just, to me, it's just, you know, 10 days of kind of brainwashing them with one point of view. And the Americans, they haven't really been aware of it. But they come back and they just parrot whatever they've been told.
I was Sharon Higgins, an Oakland-based education activist who runs a very useful website called Charter School Scandals. In the interview, she mentioned a New York Times investigation of the Harmony Schools. That's the name of the Gulen operation in Texas. It has 31,000 students and 48 schools there. The Times story examined connections between those schools and a crony network of construction companies, caterers, uniform vendors, and so on, all part of the Gulen crowd, who got no-bid contracts, all financed with public money. In late July, the AP reported that Texas is investigating the network and the request to the Turkish government in the wake of the coup. I first heard the scope of Gulen's activities from my friend and occasional behind-the-news guest, Sean Jacobs, a professor at the New School in Manhattan, who was invited on a Gulen junket several years ago. He had no idea what he was in for, but soon found himself being propagandized. So they're not only trying to reach American school kids, they're trying to lure American academics as well, or were until they lost favor with the Turkish government. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Thank you. was some of the first movement of the string quartet No. 11 by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by the Sorel Quartet. This work, written in 1966, 9 years before his death, is Shostakovich's darkest. I just love this stuff. More from that quartet at the end of the show. Next, Robert Polin. Bob is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-director of its Political Economy Research Institute. Here he is to analyze Donald Trump's alleged economic program, which he unleashed in a speech in Detroit on Monday, August 8th. People love to issue economic programs in Detroit, since it serves as a symbol of decline you can always blame on someone else. It's three-part standard Republican dogma, tax cuts, deregulation, drill baby drill, and one part sacrilege, protectionism on trade. Here's Robert Polin with more. All right, welcome, Bob. Donald Trump gave his economic policy address the other day. What do you make of it?
Well, I think we could divide it into three parts. On taxes and regulation, it's basically down the line Republican stuff that we've heard forever. All taxes are bad, so let's cut taxes. And he does throw in some things that will help ordinary people, like the child care credit. But, the big story is cutting corporate taxes, cutting regulation. So the idea that high taxes and regulations have been stifling economic growth forever, this has been the Republican mantra as long as I've been following. So that's totally conventional. And just reading the press today after his speech yesterday, that people seem to agree with that, including the Wall Street Journal. They're very happy about it. The third thing on trade, international trade, he's definitely not in the Republican mainstream, and he's very aggressive that trade deals have been bad for the U.S., bad for workers, and he's going to rip them all up. So that is a major departure. I mean, I think that he is capturing something that's real about what's happened to the U.S. working class. Trade has been one factor in causing U.S. living standards for workers to go down. It certainly has not been the only factor, but he's emphasized that, and of course he's connected it to immigration and racism, and so it's all this toxic brew. The last element is the fourth thing he talked about was energy policy, and he's saying he's going to tear up the Paris Agreement on climate change. He thinks it's all a bunch of nonsense. And he's going to let the oil companies drill, and we're going to do fracking like mad. This is truly calamitous, in my view, because if we don't take climate science seriously and start absolutely cutting emissions at a rate of, 3 to 4% per year, until we get to zero in the next 30 to 40 years, we face a climate catastrophe. That's what climate science tells us. So either you believe climate science or you ignore it altogether, and that's what Trump is talking about.
Okay, let's take each of these points in turn. He's got he wants to simplify the federal tax code by creating just three brackets where there are now, seven or so, and lower them all. This would provide certainly relief to taxpayers, but it would also be an enormous hit to revenue. And he's also talking about deep corporate tax cuts. First of all, what do you make of the personal income tax proposals?
If we're going to talk about taxes, you have to talk about taxes in the context of what you're spending money on. Now, Trump does make references to wanting to dramatically increase infrastructure spending, which is necessary. But how can you do that if you're going to cut taxes? How are you going to pay for it? Well, the truth is you're not. Cutting individual taxes, of course, all of us want to pay less taxes, but we have to cover these programs. Now, the other thing is, he's not talking about increasing business taxes. He's talking about cutting corporate taxes, so we're not going to get any extra revenue there. He certainly hasn't brought up something like a financial transaction tax, which even Hillary makes vague references to now, which would be an enormous source of revenue if it was applied even modestly. And, so basically, if anything like any of his tax proposals went through, That would mean there would be no agenda whatsoever to invest in infrastructure and the green economy. And that's basically where we are.
On the corporate tax, I often wonder who exactly pays that. Do you think actually capital pays that to any degree, or do they pass it along to their customers?
Well, yes. Well, first of all, you know, they avoid it to a quite considerable extent. So they don't pass it anywhere because they set themselves up as foreign entities. So that enables them to avoid the tax. That's this so-called inversion. And then secondly, yeah, through pass-throughs, meaning they incorporate their taxes in their prices, they pass through, and, you know, there's various range of estimates as to how much they can pass through, but for the most part, they're able to pass through their taxes into the prices that customers pay. So they themselves aren't covering it. So it does become a burden for consumers.
And the scale of tax cuts he's talking about would result, who knows exactly what the numbers would be, but trillions of dollars of revenue loss over, you know, the course of the usual budget planning decade. How alarming is that to you? Do you think, you know, are you one of those who think the government doesn't really need to tax? He could just print money?
Oh, no, I'm not one of them. I am friends with a lot of the people, like Stephanie Kelton, who, by the way, was Bernie's chief economic advisor for a while, and Randy Ray, but I don't share their view that the government can finance its activities basically through creating money. I mean, you can do some of that. In fact, I'm doing a bit of research and trying to estimate how much you can do, and I think it's, you know, it's a good number, and I don't know the right answer, but maybe it's 20% of all government activity can be financed that way. That still means 80% has to be generated through taxes. And so, yes, we have to pay taxes, and we have to do it in an egalitarian way. The kinds of tax cuts he's talking about are regressive, meaning even if it's reducing the burden on rich people and corporations. And so, so we have less revenue, we have a higher relative burden on working people, middle class people, and then we can't invest in any of the things we need to invest in: green economy, infrastructure, education.
Trump gives a lot of play to trade as a source of our economic woes and a source particularly of the woes of the American working class. What's your evaluation of the contribution of trade to declining wages and, you know, employment instability and all the unpleasantries we're very familiar with?
Globalization has certainly played a major role. Trade is a big part of globalization. It's not the only part. The other part is financial flows between countries, deregulation of finance. But look, it's true. I mean, this goes right back to our friend Karl Marx, who wrote about the reserve army of labor. You know, if you integrate the labor force of China, of Honduras, of, Bolivia, into the labor force of the United States, and a lot of the manufacturing work that can be done in the United States can be done in low-wage countries, it's going to exert downward pressure on wages. And so that has been part of the cause of the wage stagnation that has now gone on for 40 years. Now, it doesn't mean that that's the only factor causing wage stagnation. In Germany, wages are much higher. Even though wage growth has been weak, wages in manufacturing in Germany are 30% higher than the U.S., and they're running trade surpluses. That's because they use industrial policy, and that's because unions still play a significant role, in setting wages and economic policy. So if we had strong unions and if we had industrial policy that was pro-worker, it would counteract this downward pressure on wages. So it's the openness to trade, but in the absence of any egalitarian interventions, pro-worker interventions, that has caused the long-term stagnation of living standards for working people.
Let's talk about the broad economic situation for a moment. Larry Summers has gotten famous for declaring us under a regime now of secular stagnation. Somewhat unusual to find myself quoting Larry Summers approvingly, but what do you make of that?
Well, the idea of secular stagnation obviously never started with Larry Summers.
No, certainly not.
No. So it goes back to Alvin Hansen, who was, more or less a contemporary of Keynes. And then it was mainly picked up in the Marxist literature by Paul Sweezy and Baran in their book Monopoly Capital. And they were making this case for, 30 years that this was intrinsic to capitalism. And other people like that, Joseph Steindl, have been making that argument. And so all of a sudden, Larry Summers has picked it up. Now, the best as I can read, and Larry Summers has mainly done it in the form of op-ed articles and the like, there's maybe one serious, something like a serious study. But really what he seems to be talking about is not so much that this is inherent to capitalism, but that we need to generate more demand in the economy, that the government has to take a more active role in promoting demand, and investing in something like public investment in infrastructure has the benefit of raising productivity, but it also generates demand and jobs. So, in his own usual kind of vague way, Summers is capturing some of what people on the left have been saying for a long time.
The Monthly Review Stagnation School they use that to describe periods when capitalism seemed anything but stagnant to me. It seemed like it was not really a permanent situation. Now it seems historically appropriate.
Well, I mean, Sweezy, they were saying that stagnation can be offset, and it's offset by militarism and hyper-consumerism and so forth, and imperialism. So what Summers is talking, I mean, one way that one could interpret what Summers is saying is that the stagnation is reemerging because the offsets that we have are not adequate. In particular, we don't have a regime that promotes aggregate demand, but rather we have a regime that promotes financial speculation. These are not Larry Summers' words, but this is one way that you could kind of frame what Summers is saying in the more monthly review kind of tradition. If you want to, the solution that he's talking about in his mild way is building a regime that is based on rising wages and public investment in promoting more private investment. He's also even talked about his new phrase is, I think, responsible nationalism, which, of course, he'd been a huge proponent of globalization, free trade, free capital flows. So now he's backing off from that. And if one interpretation of what he's saying, this is about industrial policy, that the government should promote public investment, that the government should care about advancing productivity and jobs. That's more or less a reasonable left agenda.
I'm speaking with the economist Robert Poland of the University of Massachusetts. We have most of the so-called first world, or what we used to call the first world, in virtually no or very slow growth situation. How much of this is a real structural, long-term issue? How much of it is cyclical, post-financial crisis problem? How do you diagnose the causes of this situation?
Yeah. Well, I think that, as long as certainly in Europe and to a lesser extent in the U.S., as long as, the framework of austerity is the dominant macroeconomic framework, we're always going to be operating in a slow growth trajectory. And that is the dominant, certainly overwhelmingly in Europe, more modestly in the United States, because in the United States we do have our independent monetary policy. And so monetary policy is, of course, running the economy at zero interest rates now for 7 years. So fiscal policy has been organized or framed around austerity, since immediately after the crisis. Austerity is designed to promote slow growth. I mean, the notion that you're going to get growth by running balanced budgets or surpluses on its own, there are people, economists, that have argued that, but that's been totally refuted. The notion that having some threshold level of public debt that is going to slow growth, also argued by orthodox economists, also refuted. So basically it's time to get back to some notion of a egalitarian, aggressive public investment type agenda.
But where does this austerity lust come from? Is it bad thinking? Are there material interests involved? How do you read the causes of this fetish of austerity?
Well, I think that at the level of economics, which is less important than the level of politics and interest, but at the level of economics, you know, you had this very brief period right after the crisis where all the governments engaged in countercyclical and budget deficits and spending. This was without really having spent any time thinking about that in any depth. We didn't, you know, orthodox economists hadn't supported any of this stuff for 35 years, and then all of a sudden they're engaging in deficit spending, and then, yeah, guess what? You have public debt. So they freak out over the level of public debt, which is historically high for peacetime. That doesn't mean that it's, you know, it's going to create a crisis. So you have people like, you know, very prestigious people like John Taylor at Stanford saying that the United States as an entity, this is not even Europe, the United States as an entity is facing collapse because the public debt has gotten totally out of control. Now, John Taylor, some of your listeners, I mean, very few probably have heard of him, but he's like the most prestigious conservative macroeconomist in the country, maybe in the world. So for him to say stuff like that reflects where the profession is. Now, what are the material interests? Well, the material interests, which are more fundamental, is that, you know, since the New Deal, since the end of the Great Depression, the right has been trying to smash the welfare state consistently. They've tried to push wages down. They've tried to cut social spending and lower their taxes. And austerity is a great tool to achieve that. And that's certainly happening. I mean, look at in France. You elect a government that's so-called socialists. That's what they call themselves. And even the socialist president is saying, well, we have to promote austerity. Even in Greece, they say they're against austerity. They were voted to oppose austerity, but they were forced by the Troika, by the European Union, and by Germany to impose austerity. And what's good, the result is that, you know, wages go down, social spending goes down. So you have a regime of dominant capital.
Now, with yet another Clinton likely to be our next president, there's...
Not if everybody reads your book.
Well, I don't think the book would encourage people to vote for Donald Trump, though, so we're all in a pickle here.
No, but I want to say it's an excellent book. I'm just finishing it.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Yeah.
This moment has produced a lot of nostalgia for the economy of the Bill Clinton years, especially the late 90s. So you have people, you know, like mainstream Democrats saying those are great times. Even a lot of people, you know, older people who remember it personally will say those are great times, broadly shared prosperity, the unemployment rate actually went briefly under 4%. You had income growth across the board. The poverty rate declined dramatically. And he did it by raising taxes and balancing the budget. What do you say to all that?
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time working through those numbers, and I had a book come out in 2003 called Contours of Dissent on this, on other things, but it focused a lot on that. And I actually summarized some of the main findings in an article in The Nation about 6 months ago. The fact is that, you know, by the basic standards that you just cited, I know people say that, for example, poverty went down, and poverty did go down relative to the 8 full years of Ronald Reagan, the official individual poverty rate went down from 14% to 13.2%. So hardly a major achievement. But relative to even the so-called malaise years of Jimmy Carter, the poverty rate under Jimmy Carter was something like 11.7%. So the poverty rate was higher than it was. The official poverty rate was higher than it was under Jimmy Carter, higher than it was under Nixon and Ford. Real wages on average.
We should point out to you that the poverty rate is an absolute poverty rate, right? It's the line was set in the early 1960s and
right.
Then adjusted for inflation, and it has nothing to do with a regular average income growth.
No. This is the absolute poverty rate set in the 1960s.
So it's a very low bar.
It's a terrible measure, but just as one indicator, the poverty rate did not improve. The average real wages are actually lower. I don't remember the exact numbers right now, but the real wage was lower than it for non-supervisory workers, lower than it was under Reagan and Bush 1, significantly lower than it was under Carter, significantly lower than it was under Reagan. So this notion that this was all great times for working people and reducing poverty is just not accurate. It's true that the unemployment rate did go down briefly, but on average, if we take the full 8 years under Clinton, the unemployment rate was, you know, basically mediocre. On top of that, you know, Clinton got off easy because he left office in January 2001, and 2 months later, the dot-com bubble burst, March 2001. And so whatever gains were achieved during the bubble years were reversed immediately after he left office.
We did see an acceleration in productivity growth in the late 90s, and now we're seeing productivity declines. How much does that matter to you?
Well, you know, productivity is a double-edged sword, and it's also difficult to measure. You know, how do you measure productivity with computers, for example, when, you know, we have these massive transformations undergoing office work. So what constitutes office work changes over time. How do you measure productivity in services? You know, for me, if I teach a class of 300 people, my productivity is 10 times higher than it was if I'm teaching a class of 30 people. That doesn't mean it's good. So we have to be very careful with respect to measuring productivity. In manufacturing, yes, productivity, I think we can measure it reasonably well, and it's good to have faster productivity growth because that means you can produce better products more quickly. And, you know, there was some productivity gain under the first Clinton, tied mainly, there was a rapid rate of investment growth tied to the bubble. But when the financial bubble burst, the investment collapsed and productivity declined also.
I mentioned earlier that we're on the likely verge of another Clinton presidency. What kind of economic policies do you imagine she would preside over?
The best guess is it's going to look a lot like Bill Clinton's. And, you know, some of her advisors are excellent people. I just was looking up, you know, they don't have an official list like Trump does. But, you know, if you look at Alan Krueger, Alan Blinder, you know, these are left, or no, I don't want to say left. They're liberal economists that are excellent economists. There's no question about it. And they're, you know, generally sympathetic people. She does have some people that I would say are even more to the left. Heather Boucher is a good economist working on family issues, child care issues. I think she's even listened a little bit to Joe Stiglitz, who at this point in his career is pretty much far left. Now, so that's all favorable. Now, what she actually does with what they tell her is another matter. And what we know is that what the Clintons do is grab some of the rhetoric and some of the ideas from the, you know, Democratic Party left, puts it in a big mashup, and whatever they come out with is going to be something that Wall Street is very happy with. And so, you know, unless there is struggle around the Clinton presidency and we don't accept, and we don't just say, oh, she's got some pretty good advisors, that's where it'll end up. In my view, it'll end up looking a lot like a pro-Wall Street Bill Clinton presidency. But there are openings. And so we need to take advantage of those and fight around those.
Host Robert Poland, a professor of economics at UMass Amherst and co-director of its Political Economy Research Unit. He mentioned his 2003 book, Contours of Dissent, about the Bill Clinton years. His most recent work is Greening the Global Economy from MIT Press. Let's come up with this. Some more from Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 11. This, the second movement, the Scherzo, performed by the Sorrel Quartet, part of their marvelous set of the complete quartets. Till next week, bye.